Well, warm welcome to St. Peter's Barge, London's only floating church. If this is your first time with us, you are especially welcome. My name is Marcus Nodder. I'm the minister of the Barge Church. So welcome to our Investing for Life event. We put these events on roughly once a term. Chance just after work to hear a bit about the Christian message from someone who is working in the business community. So today we're delighted to welcome Andrew Green. Andrew works in the city, has worked in the city for over 30 years. On the investment side, as an investment advisor. I've read online he's the winner of numerous awards, but I'll spare his blushes on that, and maybe this isn't the right time to be talking about awards in investment. But but the format for this short time together is Andrew's going to speak to us on this whole subject of why I'm a Christian and explain a part of the Bible to us as part of that. Then we'll have a break for a few minutes when you're welcome to refill glasses and help yourselves with some more food. And then if you want to write down any questions you've got based on what Andrew has said, you just need to jot them down on the blue bit of paper and I'll come and collect those in. And then we'll spend the remainder of the time until 7 o'clock when we'll finish with a question and answer session. So thank you for coming, Andrew, and over to you.
Used to express safety and certainty, such as safe as houses, or you can bank on it, are now used with a wry smile at best, or more likely a sinking feeling. How on earth did we get here? Well, there has been much analysis of the dramatic events of recent days, where seeming bastions of the financial world have just been swept away almost without trace. You know the names as well as I do. Lehman's, Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, AIG, Merrill Lynch, Bear Stearns. And of course, in our own country, part of our banking system is in the process of being nationalised. All sorts of opinions have been given as to why this has occurred, whether it be the fruits of rampant capitalism, naked greed, or sheer incompetence. Well, all elements will have been present. But scapegoat hunting is not the purpose of this talk this evening. Indeed, most of us, if we are honest, will have been infected to some extent by this culture that appeared to offer so much in the material sense without ever giving the satisfaction and contentment that it promised to deliver. Indeed, many of us here this evening are part of the financial services industry, an industry, as the name implies, that exists to serve people to the best of our abilities with our financial expertise. But what we can now see is that the thought of serving others has often given way to a culture that is thoroughly self-serving. This seismic shift of emphasis has been achieved through the pressures from our company's imperative to market any product that will sell, irrespective of its suitability for the client. We've often been willing to silence our doubts and compromise our consciences because the bonus culture is so all-consuming. It became too tempting to resist, and so we all entered into a final giddy whirl of pass the parcel until the music suddenly stopped. Now, whether or not that applies to you, there will, I'm sure, be some of us who will find it all too familiar. And I've chosen this evening to look at some words of Jesus, which, though spoken thousands of years ago, are as revolutionary today as they were then. For Christians, these words have eternal relevance and power because Jesus was raised from the dead and now speaks from heaven through his word today. Though our physical eyes cannot see him, his words have the same power when received through faith as if we were gathered around him on some Galilean hillside. These words are from Mark's Gospel, chapter 10, from verse 45. And I'm just going to read from verse 43 to give context. Jesus speaking to his disciples. Whoever wants to become great among you must be your servant. And whoever wants to be first must be slave of all. For even the Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve and to give his life as a ransom for many. Now, my lovely daughter Becky asked me the other day what I was going to talk on. And I realised I'd not thought of a title, so rather unoriginally, I said, a wake-up call. And this is what these words of Jesus are. And I briefly want to make three points as we work through, and apologies for alliteration, but it's easy to remember the points as I go through them. So the first point is a shocking challenge. Second point, a shaming reality. And the third point, a saving message. So why a shocking challenge? Well, our culture will immediately reject Jesus' words as unrealistic and naive. And if we're honest, as I read those verses, I wonder how many of us thought the same. You see, our assumption is that if I live to serve others, I will end up as a doormat, and my life will be one long drudge. I may have thought that when I became a Christian some 35 years ago, but as I look back, I can only stand amazed at what God has done with such poor material. I never aimed to be a fund manager, and when asked to be one some 25 years ago, I said yes on the condition that you sack me if I don't work out. Well, so far so good. But the serious point is that if you entrust your life into Jesus' safekeeping, there is no safer place to be, whatever befalls you. Living my life for Christ is not a recipe for success in this world, necessarily, but he will give us the power and strength to live for him, and there is no better person in which to put our trust. So before we're too hasty on rejecting these words of Jesus, let us reflect on one or two things. God's Son came into the world not with trappings of power or wealth, but to serve. And this amazing truth was taken up by our forefathers in shaping the law, the government, and the monarchy. Many of the blessings that we enjoy today flow from the Judeo-Christian biblical principles that shaped our society. Think for a moment of the motto of royalty on many of the crests, are the word Ich dien, the German for I serve. The Queen remains a good example of this, with a rare sense of duty, and though much admired even by Republicans, is unlikely to be imitated. Or indeed our civil service, there's that word again, the aim is to serve the community. In fact, our whole structure of government is based on ministries, from the Latin word for servant. In fact, while we all laughed at the humour of Yes Minister, we could see how far removed this was in practice, and it did not surprise us. Indeed, one of the titles accorded the Pope is the servant of the servants of God. But the Catholic Church has not been willing to dispense with thrones and crowns and all the trappings of kingly power. And even on the most mundane level, we cannot resist a wry smile when we see a service charge included on our restaurant bills, sometimes undeservingly. Inevitably, service of others requires a measure of self-sacrifice, and that is when we start to struggle. As we reflect on the last 2,000 years of history, was there ever a king or a politician that spoke such words, or more importantly, lived such a selfless life as Jesus? Is it not striking that in this area of London, of all places, that we've come to hear the words of one who never owned a home or any possessions, though he was not against them, but came to earth with only one aim in mind, that of serving mankind? Well, who is willing to serve today? Well, in fact, there is a vast army of voluntary workers and carers that keep the wheels of society functioning, and even the nanny state that governments have constructed know that we could not function without the voluntary sector who are willing to serve. But as our laws more and more unravel their biblical thread, the whole concept of serving others in our work and our relationships becomes ever more compromised and self-serving. And this only goes to underline the uniqueness of Jesus' words, and indeed the uniqueness of Jesus. His words are both a shock and a challenge to us. The challenge is to live differently. But how? Well, my second point is a shaming reality. The context of Jesus' words that I read out just now began a few verses earlier. James and John, two of Jesus' disciples, were arguing between themselves as to their places in the kingdom of heaven. They wanted to be at the top table, seeing rank and position as their just reward for being close to Jesus. Jesus rebukes them with these words, "Whoever wants to be first must be a slave of all, for even the Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve, and give his life as a ransom for many." What is fascinating about the Bible is that all the heroes are shown warts and all. Even Peter, who was leader of the disciples, reveals in Mark's Gospel with brutal honesty his boasts of never deserting Jesus and then his craven betrayal when he denied his Lord three times. And we need to recognize that we would be no different. So here in these verses, James and John still have much to learn about discipleship. We all want to know what we're going to get out of any venture. What's in it for me is never far from our thoughts, if we're honest. And James and John have yet to understand these words of Jesus, because the path from self-serving to self-sacrificing lies through the cross. The sad reality is that we are born self-centered, wanting everyone to serve us, and those who never grow out of this can never sustain any personal relationships, marriage being a prime example. Marriage, an institution created by God, is rarely practiced by those who follow the Maker's instructions. At the heart of a successful marriage is other person-centeredness. It is all about self-giving, of seeking the best for the other person. And once again, our selfish hearts tell us that if we followed that path, we would be doormats. But God knows better, because in an environment where I know that I am loved, I am freed to love others, for I no longer need to preserve my rights. When you know the love of God, there is no greater freedom, and our response to that new freedom is a desire to serve others. So as we reflect on these words of Jesus, we come to realize that Christianity is not a crutch for the weak, but a cure for the selfish. The whole essence of the word sin is that I is in the middle of it. And any cure is painful, and it is costly, because serving others who are also difficult and selfish, like me, is bound to be tough. And the Bible is radical because it describes a rescue. It calls for conversion, regeneration, and a new heart. For it is a rescue from an old way of life. It is a rescue from ourselves. And it is a rescue from God's displeasure, because hell puts you out of reach of God's rescue. Hell can best be described as where my wish to live my life independently of God is finally granted, and granted for eternity. The shaming reality of Jesus' words will only touch us if we see that it was necessary for him to die to save us, to save us from the consequences of God's anger at our stubborn refusal to respond to his gracious offer of forgiveness. But my final point gives us a glorious hope, for it describes God's rescue with a saving message. The emphasis now is on the second half of the verse. "For even the Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve, and to give his life as a ransom for many." Recently, a group of tourists were taken captive by Somali tribesmen, and a ransom was sought for their release. Eventually, payment was made and they were set free. They had no doubt as to their captivity and the need for a ransom. But you may be asking tonight why you need to be rescued, why indeed Christ needed to give his life as a ransom for you. Well, the Bible teaches that we cannot have access to a holy God when we are decidedly unholy, when we have lived lives with little reference to God. We have lived in his world without thought or care that we are his creatures, for we neither love him nor worship him because we don't know him. Nor can we reach him by trying harder with good works or charitable deeds. It's more radical than that. I actually need a new heart. I need to begin by saying sorry. There was an article in the press the other day that none of the senior bankers who had brought their companies down had said sorry. In the words of the Elton John song, sorry seems to be the hardest word. Of course, it is often company policy never to admit anything in case you are sued. But it does describe an utter failure to take responsibility for their actions. Well, we may not run a bank, of course, but we do run our lives. And we do then need to recognize that we are responsible for our actions, the way we live our lives. Or do we seek to blame others, a seeming national pastime? Yet so rarely do we find it in our hearts to say sorry. And saying sorry to God is a good place to start. Let me put the Christian message simply. God gave up his Son for us. The Son gave up his life for us. The cross spells forgiveness. The resurrection spells new life. To know the forgiveness of God begins with saying sorry. The Bible uses the word repentance, which includes the thought to turn away from the old path and seek to go God's way. But we can only do this through God's power. So the verse Mark 10:45 that we began with sums up Jesus' life. For even the Son of Man came not to be served, but to serve and to give his life as a ransom for many. In other words, he came to earth to serve and give, not so that he could have autonomy, independence, freedom, or ambition. What Jesus did is described in another part of the New Testament like this. Because he did not count equality with God a thing to be grasped or held on to, but made himself nothing, taking the form of a servant. People didn't know that he was the Lord of the universe. He was known only as the friend of sinners. His life was not his. From the moment he was born, he was on the road to the cross, where he died to rescue sinful humanity. And our sinful hearts tell us that we should be taken advantage of, used and abused. But in reality, as the Anglican prayer book puts it, your service is perfect freedom. As G.K. Chesterton memorably said, the problem with Christianity is not that it has been tried and found wanting, but that it has not been tried. If we turn to him, asking for his forgiveness for a selfish life that has left God at the margin of our lives, he will graciously come centre stage by cleaning you up from the inside out, putting his spirit within you, urging you forward to live a life for him and not yourself. Our confidence, because of the financial crisis, will have been shaken in many of the institutions we previously trusted. Our very word confidence comes from the Latin word for faith. We have been willing to place our faith in all sorts of assumptions and promises that have been shown to be false. I'm asking you this evening to put your faith in the one whose word can never be broken, where his every promise is certain, because he has been willing to stake his very life on it, such is his love. If we feel that times are difficult, see this crisis as a life-saving wake-up call. For God serves us by saving us from hell, both in this life and the next. Well, if you want to have a chance to think through some of those points and perhaps jot down a few questions, as Marcus will say, let's have some refreshments now.
Thank you very much, Andrew. So, yeah, let's take 2 or 3 minutes, a chance just to think about what we've heard, to jot down any questions on one of the blue slips of paper, to refill your glasses, refill your plates. All the food has got to go tonight, please, so don't hold back on that. But let's reconvene in 2 or 3 minutes, and then we'll have 15 minutes of questions and answers. Thank you. Okay, if we can reconvene. And if any of you have got questions you haven't given in yet, if you want to hand them in to me, please. Well, I only had one question given in, so maybe because we're a fairly small gathering, you feel more comfortable just, a bit of interaction from the floor and heckling Andrew instead. But we'll start off with this question. I'm sure this will get the ball rolling. Do you want to join me up here, Andrew? So has the financial crisis caused people to really evaluate their priorities and greedy lifestyles, or will they simply return to type when the economy improves?
Well, I can't easily answer that. I struggle with passing judgment on everyone else's greedy lifestyle if I'm not actually looking at my own. So I think anything that happens, such as has happened, we're very foolish if we don't reflect on some of our assumptions that existed before all this happened and how we need to re-examine our thinking. And that's why it's so important, obviously most important in the spiritual realm, to constantly be willing to look at Jesus' claims on my life and on your life, so that we may have all sorts of stereotype views of what Christianity is like, or we had brush with it at school, which put us off for life, and whatever it might have been. But the re-examination of things as they occur should include also what's going on inside, and not just a world taking note of a world that's obsessed with the outside, everything from facial beauty or need to be exercising or not exercising. It's all a very me-centered lifestyle that we have in this country particularly. And I think anything as dramatic as has happened should cause us to sit down and think carefully about what we're doing with our lives, where we're going, what our aims are, and things like that.
Anyone want to come back on that, or another question? Question from the floor? Do you want to just ask it, Lewis?
Oh, okay, that's fine. It's quite appropriate for this nicely, but as a Christian, how do you keep filling your heart with the Spirit of Christ during difficult times, not become distracted or doubtful?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, very, very helpful question, because the noise of this world is often deafening. It so assaults our ears and eyes that we can't think of anything else. And that's certainly the intention, because the world would not want you to think about other things. In times like this, I cling to my Lord more than when the sky is blue and the sun is shining, I have to say. I could not do my job if I weren't a Christian. I'm not saying other people obviously can, but I can't. And I think I always relate very much to an illustration I read in a Watchman Nee book years and years ago. And it was, he mentioned just about a digestive biscuit, that if you break it in half and then put it on the table and push it together, you cannot see the break. But you only have to touch it with your finger for the fissure to be quite clear. And that's how I related to that, because this is how I see myself and my need of Christ. It is only in his strength and power that I can do what I do. I try and do it to the best of my ability, and that's all we can do. But so a situation such as we're in causes me to cling closer to him.
Any other questions from the floor? Yeah.
How do you personally made sure that your personal objectives and your professional objectives have been aligned? And can you think of a time when you've maybe met a challenge with that?
Oh, now's a good illustration. I don't think I had any particular professional aim that I wanted to get to a particular point in my career. It's been the biggest surprise to me to find that I've been a fund manager, and as I look at the tables, which include 400 or 500 unit trusts, there are only 14 others that have been doing it as long as I have, which I find extraordinary, because I have been on the point of retiring for the last 16 years. I have thought of going into a full-time Christian work several times, and been to theological college, took a year out from the city to do that. But each time I felt the Lord direct me back where he's gifted me. I suppose my personal ambitions and his aim for me are aligned in that sense, that I do want to do what he wants me to do. And I won't say that was always the case, because obviously there was a period when I was in the city when I wasn't a Christian. I think as I look back and see that he's been utterly faithful as I've sought to follow him, then I wouldn't want to depart from that. Obviously, because I'm selfish and sinful, my will often gets in the way of doing, you know, what he would have me do. And I have to learn, you know, discipleship simply means having an L plate on for life. Well, the first essential for me was to discover that I wasn't a Christian, because you're probably most of you are younger than I am, but I was brought up in a typical home where it came with the passport, and if you were a churchgoer, as my family were, I just assumed that was it. So the fact that we attended what to me seemed an absolutely dead church, and I never understood anything that was going on. So I drifted away by my mid-teens. And I had a number of health issues throughout my life, which has been, I think, probably kept me limited, if you like, than if I'd been 100% healthy. So when I started to get some success in the city and have all the sort of trappings of a house, a car, and I used to run my own cricket team and other things like that. And I thought one day when I was fielding, and the ball was coming to me and I probably dropped it, but I was thinking about, is this all there is then? You know, I had, they're very humble when you look back now, but I had all the trappings that we were told would make for a happy life. But it seemed empty to me. So I was clearly seeking at that time something more. And I was taken to St. Helen's Church by a colleague. And of course the big shock was having the Bible explained and realizing that I was a sinner. And I was furious about that because I thought it was most impertinent. And for about a year I struggled with what I was hearing. But at the same time as struggling, I was like a magnet drawing me closer and closer to him. So he was irresistible, but I was reluctant until I gave in. Any other questions?
One question. We've heard of the talk about serving, and obviously in the city it's quite money orientated. What does the Bible,
well, a lot.
In the context of
serving as well. Yeah, there's a lot in the Bible about money. Most people, because they remember a particular song, which was, I think, stemmed from the Second World War, which the title was "Money is the Root of All Evil," is incorrect, of course, because the love of money is the root of many kinds of evil. And it's that love of money, in other words, the idolatry, it's just another idol. that has usurped God's place in my life. So it's not money itself that is condemned. It's obviously how we view it. And if we see God as the giver, then I must hold loosely in my hand what he gives. In other words, passing it on as a steward, good steward of what he gives. So there's a huge responsibility on those who are wealthy as Christians, because that is a big responsibility on how you use that. And it was always an assumption by the disciples that wealth was a sign of God's blessing, and hence it's harder for a rich man to enter the kingdom of heaven than a camel that goes through an eye of a needle, was the point. That wealth isn't that particular sign of God's blessing, but it's very much a responsibility on to use what he's given well. You may want to correct me on whatever points I failed to make. Any other final? Yep.
Do you think the economic system or socialism and capitalism are equally compatible with Christian principles?
How long have we got? We've had plenty of opportunity to view socialism and capitalism, certainly if you look across the last century. And because man is in charge or running these systems, they're flawed, hopelessly flawed, as we've seen. So there is no one system that is superior. The only one I would say that should probably be higher than the others is one that takes into account the basic sinfulness of mankind. And if you have a view, which I think pure socialism does, of some earthly paradise, that is heavily flawed in my view, because we're here to muck it up. So I think when they tried the communist attempts at being fair to all, you had no different, the same hierarchy, or just a different hierarchy than you had in other systems. So whether you're in the French in the 18th century who beheaded all their hierarchy, or whether you, 200 years later, you're beheading another lot, it's there's flaws in all areas. It's basically recognizing the heart of man is sinful, and that therefore we need that cured. That is what Christ has come to do. Did you have a question?
Yes, just wanted to ask how difficult in your situation in work has ethics in the work has been, struggling with working with other colleagues as a Christian working perhaps amongst many unbelievers?
Well, I have to be careful, as I have one of my colleagues here with me this evening. I have very rarely found it necessary that I'm being required to compromise. I can't, perhaps in my heady enthusiasm as a young Christian, I required all my team to put money in a box whenever they blasphemed, 50 pence, and they were all amazed how much money was in the box at the end of the year. If people know what you believe, most people will be respectful and some even inquisitive. Obviously, I think it's easier when you become more senior because you don't get challenged, but when you're perhaps at the bottom of the pile, as I can remember being, you get a lot of ribbing and so on. But I found it's perfectly possible to work in the financial industry and be godly.
Our time is gone, so
we're going to draw stumps there. On your seats you'll find there's a little pay slip, and gives you an opportunity if you want to find out more. So here on the barge we run regular Christianity Explored courses. This card that you'll find on the table over there gives you a few details, but basically it's a course for those who want to find out more about the Christian faith. You watch a video-based presentation, you read through Mark's Gospel that Andrew's quoted from this evening, and you can ask any questions at all that you've got in a small group setting. We run this on lunchtimes, Monday lunchtimes, from 1 to 1:45. We also run it in the evening on Tuesdays at the moment from 7:30 to 9. So whether a lunchtime is suitable or straight after work, you'd be very welcome to join one of these courses. And I'd say just come along for an evening and see if it fits. And if not, we're not going to go sort of chasing you up or anything. If you'd like to join, you just need to fill in your name and email on the slip of paper, tick the appropriate box, and leave this in the wicker basket on the stairs on the way out. It's also a chance just to leave your contact details if you'd like to receive information about future events we stick on here at the barge. Again, there's an opportunity to tick a box for that. Or if you have any suggestions of topics you would like to hear a presentation on in the future, we'll welcome your suggestions. So I commend that to you. Also, just to say, we have every Wednesday and Thursday lunchtime, we have talks here on the barge. It's just a half-hour open meeting for anyone who works here in the wharf. And there'll be a 20-25 minute talk from the Bible. That's basically what the meeting is. People sit around tables. It's cafe-style format. You listen to a talk from the Bible. You can bring your own lunch if you want, or we provide some sandwich lunch. And there are three occasions a week you can do that. The details are on various literature we have on the table there. So these postcards give you the times and the days, and also these little business cards with catch on as well. So please do help yourself to those. And a final thing to say is Mark's Gospel that Andrew was speaking from. We have copies of this on the table over there. If you've never read one of the Gospel accounts in the Bible about Jesus' life, his death, his teaching, his resurrection, if you've never read one of these as an adult, even if you've had sort of contact with things maybe when you were a child in Sunday school or not even, why not take one of these away with our compliments and have a read? You might be surprised what you find in there. So I commend that to you. There are various other books as well on the desk over there, so please do have a look through, and you're welcome to help yourselves to those. Final thing to say is food. Please do fill your pockets with food on the way out, or stay around and try and hoover up a bit more, and drink's got to go as well. Do feel free to stay around. We're not going to be sort of locking the door in 5 minutes' time, so if you want to just chill out while the rain comes down, you're very welcome to. And just want to say a final thank you to Andrew on behalf of everyone for coming this evening and speaking to us. Thank you very much.